Welcome back, everyone, to the Shuttle Pod. I guess this is episode 6. We're really excited with some of the reception we've got from this. Today's date is November the 17th, 2015. My name is Jared. I'm one of the writers for Trek Movie. Along with me is...
Hi, I'm Kayla. Back here again to talk to you guys.
Brian, happy to be back.
Welcome back, you two. Also, we have a very special guest star. I think this is our first guest star we've had on the Shuttle Pod. If he'd like to introduce himself.
Hi, my name's Andy Britton. I'm a huge Star Trek fan, and I work on Mars.
You work on Mars, Andy?
Actually, what? I work on Earth, but I...
Oh, okay.
I use spacecraft to look at Mars.
So,
oh, fantastic.
So Andy is a... assistant staff scientist at Malin Space Science Systems in San Diego, California, and he has been studying Mars and its surface and its Marsiness for, what, about 10 years now, Andy?
It's Marsiness. I think that's the exact term.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've been working with Mars data since for about 10 years, kind of, if you count starting in college. Been working with different spacecraft and different instruments. Of different space agencies as well.
So we're really excited to have Andy here because he can talk about some of the real space exploration that's actually happening today. Star Trek, as we know, is all about exploring strange new worlds and the wonders of the 20-somethingth century. But what's cool about living in 2015 is that we are exploring strange new worlds right now all over our galactic neighborhood called the solar system. And even a little bit beyond, thanks to the Voyager probe, or V'ger, as it's known.
Yep.
The focus of humanity's current space exploration efforts center pretty much around the red planet Mars, which has had 20 attempted landers, rovers, penetrators, 25 orbiters, and 9 flybys. And of those, 7 are currently operational, 5 of those being run by the United States and NASA, 1 by ESA and 1 by ISRO. And
what's ISRO?
Yeah,
that's the Indian Space Agency.
Oh, great.
And ESA is obviously the European.
ESA being the European Space Agency, yes.
Right.
And so right this minute, there are 5 orbiters and 2 rovers actively doing science 225 million kilometers away. And
nice.
We are getting tons of data and studying the planet from right here on Earth. And so we're going to talk today a bit about how Mars has featured in Star Trek. How they have depicted the exploration of Mars so many hundreds of years from now, and then what we're actually doing today with our resident expert here, Andy Britton, to tell us all about the cutting edge stuff in Mars.
Specifically in the context of the pop culture phenomenon of the movie The Martian, which has gotten the red planet in everyone's mind more than it has been for a long time.
Oh yeah, such a great movie.
Fantastic. I loved it. I saw it twice.
And an amazing book.
Oh, I haven't read the book.
I have yet to read the book.
That's probably required reading if you work on Mars.
Yeah, it's definitely been going around the office a lot.
Any brief thoughts about, what did you think of The Martian, Andy?
Oh, I loved it. I loved both the book and the movie. Andrew Goddard and everyone else, Matt Damon, they did a great job paring the book down to about 2 hours or whatever the runtime was. They captured a lot of great dynamics of what it's like to be in that type of survival situation and NASA on the ground and different space agencies and the different astronauts in the story. They did an excellent job really capturing those dynamics, and a lot of the astronauts were strong scientists in their character. They didn't really have the kind of goofy astronaut characters in like previous films.
Like the scientists in Pacific Rim, who are just these crazy nerd stereotypes?
Yeah, or maybe some of the old Alien movies where the geologist is a very kind of stunt devil, take any risk, do anything, and basically get themselves killed in the movie.
Is this the new the new alien.
Yeah, like Prometheus.
Prometheus. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. My favorite part is where the geologist gets lost in a cave and he has a map.
Yeah, yeah, that wasn't very good from a mission resilience standpoint.
Though they did take some risks in the movie and in the book to make the story worthwhile.
Sure.
And save Mark Watney.
Something that I really appreciated is how they showed the logistics of space travel.
Mm.
And it's not like they're just in the air and Han Solo says, yeah, I can get you to Alderaan. It's like planning a mission takes 4 years because right. We have to coordinate fuel concerns. We have to coordinate supply concerns. And then we have to worry about things like the relative position of the two different planets in their orbits around the sun. And from your perspective, maybe you could comment to it better than I could, of course, but I just felt very realistic.
Yeah. Yeah. The movie and the book captured that well. You really need to really consider all those things, resources, orbital dynamics, just like you said.
Very cool.
So why don't we dive into Star Trek a little bit?
Let's do it.
I just wanted to mention some of the episodes in which Mars features. And then we can talk a bit about those. So I went, of course, onto our favorite resource, Memory Alpha. And if you look Woo-hoo. Up Mars on Memory Alpha, it lists every single episode in which Mars even had a passing background reference. And so there's a ton of actually fun little background things that I never knew about having to do with Mars, going all the way back to TOS The Cage, where the Talosians scan a record of Mars. And I think you see this just kind of pass by on the screen. The Changeling in TOS. The orbit of Mars is depicted on Chart 14A, the Sol system, which was stored in the Enterprise Library computer scanned by Nomad.
Nice.
And there's a bunch of those. There's a myriad of examples of these. But one of my favorites was from The Next Generation. I guess it appears a couple of times in Season 1, where in the background or on a pad or something on a panel, you see an image of long extinct Martian insects within some acoustograms. And they're these just like green outlines of these insect looking things. I think there's even a mention somewhere on the acoustograms that they're silicon based life forms. So I just thought that was like an interesting little like throw to, you know, people looking for life, a little nod to people who are looking for life on Mars today.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
Of course, there's DS9's Little Green Men, where humans from 1947 thought that Nog, Rom, and Quark were from Mars.
I think that's a fantastic episode.
Oh yeah,
I think it's sometimes Trek struggles with some of its humor, but that one is just phenomenal.
It's one of my favorite DS9 episodes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Same here.
And there's little bits of like the history of I try my best to recreate the history of Martian exploration through the eyes of the Star Trek universe in what's canon. And so, for example, we know that there were Martian colonies on Mars that took hold in 2103, established in TOS The Court Martial. It's also established in Wolf in the Fold and in an Enterprise episode, Terra Prime, that the colonies mm-hmm. eventually developed into domed cities. So that we eventually, I wouldn't say terraformed Mars, but made habitats where humans could live on Mars.
Sure.
Right. Yeah, The other thing important to mention about Enterprise is Mars is actually featured in the intro because there's the shot of the Mars rover.
Yeah, that's right. It's Sojourner, isn't it?
Yep. Mm-hmm. Oh.
And so the two biggest episodes where we see Mars in Star Trek is, again, that Enterprise episode, Terra Prime, where I think there's a planetary defense system on Mars. It's like a big cannon that they were like shooting things out of the sky with, and so you actually see the surface. And then in a Voyager episode called One Small Step, where it throws back at the beginning to the year 2032, where a mission called the Ares 4 was one of the early manned missions to Mars, people on the ground and one of the astronauts in an orbiter. And the guy in the orbiter gets taken over by this giant spatial distortion thing. It looks like some giant weird sun thing. And it like eats him up and he's basically trapped in there. And it enters and exits subspace randomly. And so it appears in the Delta Quadrant and Voyager sees it. And they decide for some reason to send a probe inside. And then, or they to send the Delta Flyer inside to try to recover this Mars, this Ares 4 capsule. And so they go in and try to, because it's a piece of their history, and so they're going in to find
sure.
it.
You mentioned that something, I saw the movie The Martian twice, and I felt kind of dumb. It wasn't until the second time that I realized why they call it the Ares mission.
Mm. Right.
Which should have been like the first thing on my mind. Maybe everyone else caught that a little faster than I did, but
it's okay, Jared.
Thank you, Brian. Thank you. That's what I was looking for. It was validation from you.
Yep. Ares, Mars, the god of war. Yes.
Yep. One's Roman, one's Greek. And then, of course, the Martian defense perimeter is referenced in Best of Both Worlds Part 2, as we see the Borg, like, rampaging through the solar system, but they didn't really have much of a budget, so it's just, like, three little ships shoot out, and the Borg cube takes care of them without any trouble at all.
Of course.
Yeah. Too bad they didn't still have that big cannon from Terra Prime.
Right. It wasn't working anymore by then.
Yeah. Budget cuts, I think, is what it was.
So why didn't the Borg want to assimilate Mars? Not enough people?
Wow.
Maybe they're going for numbers. Maybe there's not enough people on Mars. They just wanted a shortcut and go straight to Earth.
Yeah, or they figure, like, Earth is the center of the Federation, and so you get Earth, you get the rest. I don't know.
Yeah. That's probably more likely.
Although, you have to get the moon, too, in Tycho City.
Yeah, that's true. Oh, they do. Do they? I'm trying to remember now. In First Contact, do they mention the colonies on the moon?
Riker does when he's in the Phoenix.
Yeah, when they're blasting off. But what about when you see the planet Earth being assimilated? I don't know if they actually ever mentioned whether or not the... I mean, I guess we assume that the moon would have been
next. We assume they got the moon, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think they mentioned it at all.
Yeah, I guess you figure if they got Earth, there's only a matter of time they were going to get the moon.
Sure.
Pretty easily, so.
You think it's kind of hard to hide it.
Yeah. Yeah. So one of the other things I'm excited to talk with Andy about is that the Enterprise D was launched from Mars. It was launched from the Utopia Planitia fleet yards in 2364. And Utopia Planitia on the ground, the surface of Mars, is where... not only Enterprise D was designed, but also where Ben Sisko helped design and test the Defiant. And Utopia Planitia is a real place on Mars, right, Andy?
Yep. Yes, it
so,
is.
Yeah, like, where is it? What's Utopia Planitia like?
It's in the Northern Hemisphere. It's part of the Northern Plains, these lowlands that are just north of some highlands. And it's very flat. It's pretty rocky. One of the Viking landers actually landed there, Viking 2, in 1976. And it's a pretty cold, deserty place. Lots of volcanic rocks. There's some volcanoes nearby. Lots of impact craters.
It's a pretty big region, right?
Yeah, it's a big, wide open, very large region on Mars. In the eastern hemisphere, the northeast hemisphere of Mars.
Sounds like the perfect place to build a galaxy-class starship.
Perfect, perfect.
You could definitely build some large items out there in those planes.
So one question I have about if we were to be building stuff on Mars when we eventually live on Mars, what is the conditions like there relative to Earth in terms of things like the atmosphere and the gravity?
So the gravity is 2/3 that of Earth. It's Mars is about, is that right? Sorry, gravity is 1/3 that of Earth. Mars is 2/3 the size of the Earth. The atmosphere is 100 times thinner than the Earth. So if Earth had, say, 100 shoeboxes stacked up on top, Mars would just get one shoebox for atmosphere. So the atmosphere is very thin. It's mostly carbon dioxide. A lot of people, when they look at pictures of Mars, they see this desert. So they think of hot temperatures. But Mars is actually freezing cold. So since there's some atmosphere, we do get things like dust storms. We get little dust devils. There's water ice clouds and seasons and frost. So there's actually a quite a dynamic planet there. this fourth rock from the sun.
So there's weather.
Yep.
Yes. Yes. And I actually write a weather report for my company, and NASA links to that. We have a weather camera in orbit around Mars on the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter built, one of the NASA spacecraft.
So now, in terms of the way that was depicted in the movie The Martian, was that particularly realistic? Did they get the science right?
Yeah, so if you watch the Martian movie, you see nice expanses of like red desert. They looks like they added some craters using some CGI. They even have dust devils in the back, and they did a good job with the look of the Martian, look of Mars in the movie The Martian. They filmed a lot of that out in Jordan, in the desert.
Oh, interesting. Oh, I didn't realize that.
I was wondering where they actually shot that.
I just assumed it was all on a green screen. I guess I was wrong.
Yeah, it's probably, possibly not too far from Petra, where they filmed Indiana Jones and Last Crusade.
Cool.
Now, were there any scientific inaccuracies that they depicted?
In The Martian?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, there's a number of inaccuracies. So, as I was saying before, Mars has a very thin atmosphere. So, it would... You'd have a hard time flying a kite on Mars, let alone having a dust storm really blow a lot of material, blow objects around, big objects, and hurt astronauts.
Because there's just not enough atmosphere for wind to develop that fast.
Right. Yeah.
But Andy, at one time there was a more dense atmosphere, right?
Yes, in Mars's past, we see big flood features on Mars, these huge canyons and valleys. So that tells scientists like myself and colleagues that Mars once had a thicker atmosphere. It had these big flood events over the planet from time to time. These floods were likely episodic. And yeah, there's a lot of other evidence that points toward a thicker atmosphere on Mars.
Huh, so what happened?
Well, that's one of the scientific questions we're currently trying to answer. We're trying to understand what happened to Mars's atmosphere with some NASA spacecraft like MAVEN. MAVEN just got into orbit about a year ago. That looks at Mars's atmosphere and different types of volatiles in the atmosphere. So the kind of short story of the answer is that the sun and the solar wind blew away a lot of that atmosphere that Mars had. And Mars doesn't have a strong magnetic sphere, a shield like the Earth has. The Earth's magnetosphere protects our atmosphere from the sun and the solar wind.
But Mars doesn't have that advantage.
No. Something, if it did have that dynamo, that geodynamo in the interior of the planet that creates the magnetosphere, that at one point shut off. And we don't clearly yet know why, and we have some ideas about when, and it probably shut off pretty early in the age of the solar system.
Interesting.
Is the atmosphere stable at the moment, or is it still deteriorating?
It's still getting blown away by the solar wind. I forget what the rates are, but that some of that data has been recently published by NASA using the MAVEN spacecraft.
So is there eventually someday Mars will have no atmosphere at all?
It'll take a very long time. Mars's atmosphere will probably continue to thin as the solar system ages and as the sun ages. Of course, the sun will eventually turn into a red giant and probably accelerate that process of blowing away the atmosphere.
Yeah. That's a future that none of us are looking forward to.
Yeah. Luckily, we have another, 4.5 billion years until that happens?
Yeah, we have a good handful of billions of years before that happens.
So how, and you know, this may be too big of a question to ask, how long until we can put a human being on Mars?
Yeah, because according to Star Trek, early manned missions were as happening as early as 2032. So we better hurry up.
We got 17 years.
Yeah, and that was not even the first one. Presumably it was the fourth one that was called Ares 4.
Oh, you're right.
So, well, we don't know if they had landed a person, but it was one of the earliest, presumably not the first person on Mars happened in 2032 in the Star Trek universe.
Okay. Is that from TOS?
That is from the Voyager episode One Small Step.
Okay. Oh, okay.
So NASA's currently working on technology and methods and basically the pathway for getting humans to Mars, hopefully by the mid-2030s.
Yeah, so not too far off.
Oh, yeah, that's actually pretty precise.
Go Star Trek.
Woohoo!
So what...
And yet another thing Star Trek got right.
Right, we projected the Mars landings.
Now we need to rationalize somehow why a genetic Superman didn't rampage across India in the mid-1990s.
That's okay. I'm happy they got that one wrong.
Right.
Yes, good point.
So you're saying they're developing the technologies to get humans to Mars and understand a lot of the barriers with things like, radiation shielding of the astronauts and, like, health of the astronauts just getting there. But what are the biggest problems or the biggest technological advances that we need to overcome?
So some of the biggest technological advances that we need to overcome is to be able to land large masses onto the surface of Mars safely. Mm. So NASA's working on their kind of heat shield, their inflatable heat shield. They've been launching several tests over the Pacific with that. They are working on their SLS rocket, which is a very large rocket, larger than the Saturn V, because you need a large rocket to get humans to Mars.
And the Saturn V is what launched the lunar missions.
Correct.
Right. And it's hard to imagine a rocket bigger than the Saturn V. My God.
Yeah.
It's the size of a skyscraper, isn't it?
Oh, okay. It was, over 30 stories tall.
Yeah.
About 36, if I remember correctly. And so NASA is always conducting experiments on the International Space Station. We have Scott Kelly doing over about a year in space. We're looking at the human physiological challenges and even sociological challenges for having long space travel.
Is it referred to as space madness, or is there a better, more precise term?
I don't know the precise term, actually. I doubt it's called space madness.
You never know what those psychologists are getting up to. Oh, and fun fact, Andy, you mentioned Kelly, the astronaut who's spending a year in space right now. I believe he's up there right now. The astronaut who we meet in Voyager One Small Step, his last name was Kelly as well. So,
really?
Yep.
Wow.
That's awesome.
I watched that episode just recently this last week in preparation for talking about it on the podcast, and I was just like, hey, Kelly's up in space right now. Good job, Star Trek.
Wow. It's another one. Boy, they are
two for two.
Batting a thousand when it comes to Mars.
He's not going to Mars, but he is spending a year in space, which has anyone ever done that before? Maybe the Russians have done that before, but I don't
think the Russians have done that. Americans, this will be the longest American in space.
Interesting. And
we're breaking records.
Oh, but the cool thing, right, and Andy, you're the one who told me about this, is he's a twin, isn't that right?
Yeah. So his twin, Mark Kelly, who is married to Gabrielle Giffords in Arizona, is also an astronaut, and Mark is down on Earth. And they are looking at the physiological differences between the two brothers and comparing the effects of space. And they have a really good data set. They have a unique data set, a unique
So Mark is the control
opportunity.
That's nice that they have that. I wonder how they decided. Did they each roll a D6, and whoever rolled higher got to be the astronaut.
That was good, Jared.
Thanks. Thanks. It all comes down to Dungeons and Dragons comparisons to me. Okay, here's a something. I mean, I live in Washington, D.C., and I went to an event on Capitol Hill once where they were talking about space travel. And they said the reason that they speculated that there would never be astronauts to Mars, or at least not in any foreseeable future, because it's so much less expensive to send robots.
Who is they?
And the person who spoke with this was an economist of some kind, I think. Sorry, okay. I should have introduced that a little better. Because to send a robot, you don't have to worry as much about life support. You certainly don't need to worry about space madness or whatever. But then you also didn't need to worry about bringing them back. And so it's a lot more simple. I'm glad to hear that economist's prediction was not accurate, and that we are working on getting human beings onto our neighboring planet.
That economist's rationale is the same rationale some people in the Kennedy administration had at the beginning of the space program too. Yeah, just send a probe up, grab some rocks, and come back.
So,
but nothing beats
boots on the ground.
Need to bear witness to an event in order for it to.
Well, it's not. I mean, it's not only that. And Andy can talk more to this because he knows actually the stuff that needs to be done on Mars. But you know, as a geologist, I can totally speak to this. Like, you know, the work that can be done by a human on the surface of a planet in about an hour probably takes a rover what.
Six
months
years
or
plus.
years yeah. Holy no cow. Seriously, because you know, like, and you know, every little move of the robot has to be pre-programmed, and they have to wait, and there's like a what, you know, there's a significant time delay because the speed of light is only so fast, so there's a significant time delay over the radio to speak with the thing, to figure out where it's been, tell it what to do, decide what to do. And a human can just go pick up a rock, throw it in a bag, you know, make the decision right there on the spot and do tons of work. So it's, yeah, there's nothing beats having a human actually there.
I agree. Exploration is, with spacecraft, is one thing. Human exploration with human eyes, with EVAs, is another thing. It's colonizing, it's exploration. It has that, it really satisfies that nature that we have of what's over that hill, what's on the other side of that ocean.
Mm-hmm. Totally agree.
To slip the surly bonds of gravity and touch the face of God, or whatever that line is?
Yes.
Correct.
Bonds of Earth.
Right.
There we go. Surly bonds of Earth, not gravity. Dang it. I knew I should have looked it up before I started it.
Close enough.
Thank you.
And I think Roddenberry really understood that.
Yeah, and in fact, something we've talked about before is how, like, a seminal point of the original series is Kirk outwitting computers to show that the human touch will always be important.
Right.
So one of the great things that is starting to happen is NASA and other space agencies are really starting to work out how humans can work with spacecraft. How can humans work with robots to accomplish multiple tasks in a single day or in a single mission? So when the astronaut is sleeping or eating or resting, the rover or a robot can be completing other tasks. The rover could serve as a kind of safety vehicle. It could serve as transportation. It could carry, robots could carry and assist astronauts in numerous ways.
Oh, so there's a role for robots in terms of the exploration to assist the human astronauts.
Yes.
I guess we saw that in The Martian. He used Mark Watney used a lot of the tools he had available to him, like the rovers that he had. Or I guess not the rovers, but the
lander, Pathfinder.
Yeah.
And the, like, oh my God, what are they called? The dune buggy things.
You could call it a buggy. Like a lunar buggy, like the Apollo missions.
Right.
Yeah. The MAV. Right?
The MAV is the Mars Ascent Vehicle, yes.
Oh, darn. I can't keep all the acronyms straight.
There's a lot of acronyms in space agencies and space work.
We refer to them in Washington as TLAs, or three-letter acronyms. Thank you. Thank you. Okay, this may be deviating a little bit from your subject matter expertise, so I apologize if that's true in advance. Andy, why haven't we worked toward getting to Venus? Why is Mars a more attractive target for exploration than our sister planet?
So Venus can be challenging to get to. Venus's atmosphere is 90 times thicker than Earth. So it's very thick, and it has a runaway greenhouse effect, so much that the surface of Venus is hot enough to melt lead.
Whoa.
So it's hard to keep electronic equipment and other things surviving on the surface. You could try to do a crude exploration, a human exploration to the atmosphere of Venus. You could try to do something like that. But to get humans on the surface of Venus would pose many technological challenges. And Mars is pretty Earth-like and pretty interesting to check out. Venus definitely has a lot of challenges.
Because if we flew a group of astronauts into the atmosphere, they'd basically melt. It'd be like flying into a furnace.
Yeah, you'd want to enter pretty slowly, probably with all that atmosphere that you're compressing and causing friction to occur. You could parachute down pretty slowly because the atmosphere is so thick. But because of the atmosphere and other characteristics, it's very hot on the surface. There's nasty sulfur chemicals. There's challenges with the weather and communication because you have to get through all that atmosphere and all those clouds.
We did send a probe through there at one point, didn't we, Andy, recently?
Yeah. The Europeans just ended their Venus Express mission not too long ago. They had an orbiter. The Russians have had some success with Venus. They had the, I think it's the Venera probe, land and take pictures. The U.S. has also had other spacecraft, such as Magellan, to do mapping, and also have done like atmospheric probes as well.
In terms of just getting there, would it be easier to get to Venus than it would be to Mars?
I don't think it's too much more challenging. I'm not a aerospace engineer, so I don't do the orbital dynamics. I should probably play the Kerbal Space Program on my computer. But I don't think it's too much more challenging. I think you have the gravity of the sun somewhat helping you. It could take a little while, and you use different orbital dynamics to get there.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, I didn't mean to ask you something out of your area of expertise. Just we're talking about Star Trek, and you're the royal science person, and so I assume you must know everything about every branch of science.
I know I'm kind of a jack of all trades when it comes to planetary science, as well as some astronomy and engineering. Master of none.
Well, I hope you're master of some.
I know some Mars stuff.
Did you have a specific favorite part of The Martian that you liked the most?
I liked the technological challenges. I like that Mark Watney had to use science and engineering to survive.
I liked
a lot of the scenes in the movie that showed the kind of wide expanse of the terrain of Mars that they depicted. They, like I said a little bit earlier, they had some dust devils in the background, which is nice because a lot of people kind of think of Mars as not as dynamic as it is weather-wise.
I particularly enjoyed the running gag about him being a space pirate and the maritime law.
Yeah.
I thought that was pretty funny.
That was pretty great.
That was good.
I also appreciate it in terms of showing the science that you described, that they showed a variety of different science, that, you know, like he's a botanist, and then they have somebody who's a chemist, and then the Donald Glover character, he is the, I don't know what you'd describe it, astrophysicist, astroengineer.
Mm-hmm.
But that seems like the kind of thing where if I were an elementary school teacher, I would just be delighted to be able to show that to a group of kids in science to say, okay, this is the kind of thing that you're learning the foundations of, so someday some of you kids will be able to do this in real life too.
Yeah, if I was a teacher, I'd probably be showing that in classroom when I could.
Yeah. Huge recruitment video.
Oh, you fantastic. Fantastic. You know, and then the movie ends with him teaching prospective astronauts. So
that's right.
They really hung a lantern on it.
They did. They did. Our favorite saying.
Yeah. I appreciate that you taught me to me. I love they have this. I was disappointed that there weren't any Star Trek references in the movie. And the second time I saw it, I was trying to pay extra special attention for any kind of little Star Trek joke, you know, or even I was expecting somebody to make a wisecrack about boldly going where no one has gone before or whatever. And I was sad that there wasn't. But there's a great Lord of the Rings joke in there.
Oh, my God. Yeah, like, that's one of the great movie references ever.
Super
ever.
Nerdy reference there.
Ever. Yeah, where they're sitting there and they're trying to come up with this scheme to get Mark back. And they refer to it as Project Elrond. And then Kristen Wiig, who's the one non-nerd in the group, she says, wait, Project Elrond, what does that mean? And then Brian, who is it that explains to her what it is?
Sean Bean.
Sean Bean, who is
significant. Who played Boromir.
Of course. And who was at the Council of Elrond.
That was at the Council of Elrond, yeah.
Yeah,
that was great.
I was expecting him to say, one does not simply plan a mission to Mars.
That would have been taking it a little too far, but I think we all would have loved it.
Yeah, that would have been taking it too far, but, you know, I would have laughed. And then the Jeff Daniels character... he says, if this is Project Elrond, I want my code name to be Glorfindel, which is such a glorious reference because only people who've read the books
right,
get
it's
that.
It's a literary reference.
Because
right.
Glorfindel was replaced in the movie with the Arwen character, the Liv Tyler character.
Right.
I absolutely love that. And I thought the Jeff Daniels character, in terms of being a scientist and a politician in his role, I felt his depiction was very accurate in terms of the concerns he had. Because mm-hmm. everyone else is just thinking, oh, well, we've got to get Mark back. We've got to do this. How do we figure out the science of this? And his rationale was, how do I keep Congress and the public happy so that they don't cut my funding next year?
Right. Yeah, which also is like, so I don't have to fire, you know, tons of people beneath me. So it's...
Oh, sure. Yeah, his leadership role as well.
Yeah. So I think that was a great depiction because NASA is, I mean, obviously being a government agency, they have to worry about these kinds of things.
Right.
So it's a different kind of game.
Mm-hmm. I feel like we've talked this out really well in terms of the Martian, Star Trek stuff, and then real life science stuff. Does anybody have any closing thoughts?
Yeah, I think we should all take bets on whether or not we think that there's life on Mars.
I think there will find evidence that life at one point existed on Mars.
Yeah, I'll go with that.
Maybe fossilized microbes or something.
Yeah, right. Yeah, something right. like that.
I'm looking at an image from Memory Alpha of the Terra Prime episode in Enterprise, and it looks like their shot of the cannon firing into space. For that defense, it looks like from the image, it looks like it was probably some kind of murky weather going on. It looks like it was maybe not so much of a sunny day. Maybe there is some dust particles suspended in the atmosphere. Maybe there's a regional dust storm happening nearby. Looks pretty murky. Kind of, you have some atmosphere obscuring the terrain in the background.
So is that?
So that would suggest that it was terraformed then.
Well, was it? Did they mention terraforming in?
Well, no. They. So the official canon, I suppose, is that there were colonies that had been developed into domed cities. So not terraforming, but rather having like discrete environments where people could live in.
Got it.
But it looks like some weather was happening near.
I mean,
near
is that consistent
in the time of
is that
episode?
Realistic. The way it looks?
Yeah, it looks pretty realistic to me. Good colors, pretty good CGI for an Enterprise episode.
I like how you qualified that.
It was 2005 on UPN. I'm inclined to give them the benefit of the
doubt. Right.
Yeah, it was good.
Cool. Well, one closing thought I had, I try to end these with a Trek anecdote, and sometimes we're able to get some of them from you guys who may tweet them to us or post comments on our website. So if you have any, share them with me. This is a little tangential. My favorite episode of The Twilight Zone, which I feel is the sister series to start the original series of Star Trek, because they use science fiction as a way of talking about social issues and whatnot, as well as having an enduring legacy and telling great stories. My favorite episode is called "Will the Real Martian Please Stand Up?" And it's the first couple minutes. What happens is there's this bus that gets pulled over because there's this UFO sighted, and you know the police are afraid of what's going to happen to people on the bus. And they find out there's one person too many on the bus for what the itinerary says. And the deduction they come to is that one of them is a Martian. Yeah. And so they're all like in a diner and everyone's pointing fingers at each other like, oh, you're the Martian. Oh, why did you say that? You must be the Martian. Oh, you're too weird. And there's one guy who says, oh, this is like science fiction. This is like something from Ray Bradbury. And the episode came out like 1952 or something. It's very meta. It's extremely funny. And most Twilight Zone episodes, you know, it's just the setup, then a lot of filler, and then a twist at the end. And this is just fantastic all the way through. So if you're a fan of TZ, you know, get on Netflix or wherever, check that episode out. It is a fantastic, albeit ludicrous, depiction of Mars.
Yeah, I'll have to check that out.
It's like a whodunit of Martians.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
I have the whole series. I'm gonna have to go look for that one.
I think it's magnificent. And then there's a guy in there who plays one of the characters that they get off the bus, who also plays the doctor in The Cage, Dr. Boyce, I think his name was. So it's fun to see a familiar face there.
Cool.
Nice.
Yeah. Alrighty. Well, special thanks to our subject matter expert, Andy. Thanks for joining us. We appreciate it.
Yeah, really, Yankee. Thank you very much.
Yeah, anytime.
It was great having you as our first official guest. Yay!
Yay! And Andy, as you have interesting things you mentioned, the weather reports, we're happy to tweet them out to our followers.
Yeah, and we'll throw them up when we post the podcast on the website.
Oh,
put them up there in the show notes.
Absolutely.
So those of you listening to this may have already been able to check it out.
So if you want to know, how often do those come out? Weekly?
Yes, weekly. Generally on Wednesdays.
Oh, perfect. That's when we try to have our podcast come out. So if you want to know what the weather on Mars is like on the day, at the exact time you are listening to this podcast, you can check that out on our website.
Awesome. I mean, what other podcast can offer you that? I mean, seriously.
Probably just no. Ours.
Just yeah. Ours. We're the exclusive. All right. Well, thanks, everybody. Thanks for listening. Again, today is November 17th, 2015. I'm Jared.
I'm Kayla.
I'm Brian.
Andy.
I'm Andy.
There we go.
The guest.
There we go.
And we will see you out there.
See you next time. Bye, guys.
Bye, everybody. Bye.
Peace and long life.